listening to the Red Sea Podcast, part of the Over the Monster Network.
Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champions.
Hosted by Jake Devereaux.
It's gone! It's into the bullpen! This game is tied! This game is tied! David Ortiz!
And featuring Keaton DeRosier.
It's a grand slam!
I'm telling you!
Welcome back to the Over the Monster podcast. This is your host, Jake Devereaux, and today I'm joined by both Matt Collins and Keaton DeRosier of Over the Monster to talk about not only the draft, but some pretty depressing baseball comments from the worst commissioner in the world, Rob Manfred. Today's rundown of the show, we're going to get into all those things. We're going to talk about specifically in the draft class, thoughts on their strategy. We're going to grade the draft class as best we can. Talk about our favorite picks, least favorite picks, update you guys on the undrafted or the unrestricted free agents that the Red Sox signed, and then we'll hit up some listener questions. So before we do that, guys, first time we've been on as a trio in a while. How are you guys doing?
Peachy. Yeah, doing great.
Nice. You guys got any good beverages in front of you for this this discussion on Manfred? Because I poured myself a gin before we talk about this.
I just poured a Dr. Pepper.
Nice.
I probably should have gone with something stiffer.
Bissell Brothers, I forget what it's called. Nothing Gold, I think.
Oh, Nothing Gold's great. Yeah, you've got real good beer up there.
Now I feel left out.
It's not bad.
All right, so let's get right into it. Matt, I think I'm going to go to you first on this one. What were your impressions of Manfred's comments today? Do you really think that there is a danger of no season at this point? Was this just posturing? I mean, what was all this by Rob Manfred?
I mean, I think it certainly isn't an original thought, but I think it's pretty clear that this is just a stall tactic. I mean, the players said over the weekend, like, we're done negotiating. You guys have the power to set the schedule. Just do it and we'll show up. But they know, the league knows that when they impose the 48-game schedule, the players are going to file a grievance, and the players are going to win that grievance because the agreement they made in March said owners have the power to set the schedule, but there has to be a good faith effort to get as many games on the schedule as possible. Obviously, since the league just offered a 72-game schedule, they could never argue that 48 games is the most that they could get in. That's just not how math works. So they need to probably stall things out for another at least 2 weeks to really make the 48-game or 50-game or 52-game or whatever they end up doing really make sense and be able to argue it in front of a third-party arbiter. So it's an insanely transparent stall tactic that benefits really nobody, and it's just the owners and Manfred as their mouthpiece kind of throwing a little bit of a temper tantrum because they haven't lost a negotiation. And honestly, it's probably been at least around 20 years since they really lost a negotiation to the players union. Players union has been losing power for a long time, and so it just seems like the owners have no idea what to do when they're losing a negotiation. Their response is just to be wildly immature and throw a massive temper tantrum and just kind of dare to cut off the whole season.
Yeah, it was pretty great. I loved Trevor Bauer's response to this immediately on Twitter.
Yeah, they're making me agree with Trevor Bauer, if that's any indication of how horrible all of this is.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going with that is, you know, when Trevor Bauer's the most rational person, you know that 2020 has really hit hard. But Keaton, I wanted to get your take on this as well. You know, Manfred's comments that he made about there potentially being no season this year are contrary to what he's kind of said all along with his guarantee that there would be baseball and all these things. But there does seem to be some small vocal minority of teams, MLB teams, like maybe 6 to 8 owners or something like that. Maybe it's even smaller, but that seems to be the general size of the ownership that's actually pushing for this no season. I mean, what do you make of that? Do you believe that there are really owners who really don't want to play this season out?
It wouldn't shock me if they were that idiotic, but it just, I can't believe that they actually see that as a viable option, or they wouldn't. I mean, I'm expecting exactly what Matt said, that it's just all posturing. I mean, in one of the previous offers that they made to the Players Association, it was 70-something games, but they were only going to pay them for 48. So the players have said they're ready to play, and they just want the schedule to be set, but they're not going to take a pay cut for it. So MLB is just stalling until they can pay them for 48 games and make them play 48 games. That's basically just what they're getting to.
Yeah.
So it really feels like that's where we're headed. But, I mean, at this point, I've been pretty pessimistic each time that I've been on this podcast about there even being a season in the first place. I can't remember what I said last time with my percentage, but it was incredibly low. So I know it wouldn't shock me if there were owners that would prefer not to play. But if that's the case, then I think that drives up the likelihood that there'll be a strike in 2022, and the sport cannot survive two lost seasons in 3 years. It just can't.
No. And that's the thing that's so troubling to me about all these negotiations is just that it takes away from a game that has already been declining in terms of the amount of people who are watching it with regularity and its favorite status in America. It lost that long ago, but it seems to be trending in the wrong direction for that. And all these offers by MLB have essentially been the exact same amount of money, just shown to the players in different ways. So it's been very frustrating to look at that. But Matt, I wanted to get back to you. Why on earth would an owner, one of these hypothetical owners, that doesn't want the season to play, I mean, what do they stand to really gain from that? Because it seems like if they don't play, they're not going to get all that playoff TV money. And it seems like there's still quite a bit of money to be made before the playoffs even start. I know that there's some regional TV contract money that they could still get from that. I mean, it seems like it doesn't make a ton of financial sense not to want to play.
I mean, the teams with the smaller TV contracts, and I'm not entirely sure how postseason TV money gets divvied up. I don't think it's just like every team gets 1/30th of it. I would assume the teams that are actually in the playoffs get a little bit more. I might be totally off base on that. But it seems like the speculation that I've seen is that some of the smaller market teams that weren't going to make the playoffs this year were the teams that would be most likely to not want a season. So I would assume that has something to do with the playoff money. But I will admit to some ignorance on how those billions of dollars are handed out. But I mean, I think we should add on the topic of playoff money. In the midst of all this, yesterday they agreed to a deal with Turner Sports worth $1 billion for Turner to carry one playoff series.
Oh my God.
It doesn't go into account until, I think, 2022. So technically that money's not in their pocket right now. But just as like an idea of what they're making in the playoffs, you can imagine what they're getting from Fox, who carries one round or one series every round at least. This is what they're getting for literally one playoff series. They get $1 billion for that. It's just, they're such a joke.
I can't hear $1 billion and not think of Dr. Evil every time.
It's a very timely reference right there. That's apt for a discussion about Major League Baseball, which is also stuck in 1998.
Yeah, it really is. And we even got the 1998 flashback with that great 30 for 30 last night. So got to relive your childhood there, Matt. Did you end up catching that?
No, I fell asleep at like 8:45 last night. That's a different discussion. Well,
got to relive that at some point. But I mean, this whole thing is really depressing. Hopefully they get it figured out. But I think, Keaton, to your point, you're absolutely right. The broader problem here is that the players are definitely showing solidarity, which is not the problem. That is great. I'm happy that the players are finally showing solidarity together and they're not caving to these demands. So I think ultimately, like, that's a good thing for the sport, but you're absolutely right that this is setting up a nasty negotiation between these two sides that I have a really hard time thinking that there's not going to be a strike after the 2021 season.
Lockout.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about there.
Yep. I mean, I've been feeling that way for the past couple seasons, just the way that just the overall general relations between the players and the league has been, and this has just completely torpedoed it into the ground, and I've never had more belief in a 2022 lockout than I do after all this madness.
Well, maybe we'll get to see a Juice Trout after this, and you know, we'll have another home run era.
Shit, I forget what I was going to say now. Forget it. I lost my train of thought.
The idea of Juice Trout is too much.
Yeah, that went right to my head. No, I think the thing, like, I always kind of thought that the negotiations were never going to be easy. I think now I'm just, like, extremely dreading how public they're going to be. I think this is just, like, if this was all happening behind closed doors, it would be one thing. But that every, like, 2 days, we're getting leaks, and it's just like, I don't need to hear about all this, man.
It makes it
especially that one's
going
to last an entire year. Like, it's
the
just,
leaks are all coming from the league, too.
Oh, for sure,
to try and paint the players in this negative light, and it's completely backfiring. Like, it actually, we'll give them credit. It was working in the beginning.
But it was working up until, just, like, 10 days ago, I feel like.
Yeah, the tide has completely turned on them, and they've really overplayed that hand.
I don't understand how anyone rational at this point looks at this and doesn't blame the owners for 99.9% of what's happening right here.
I mean, I know how. It's not a very nice answer. I might not make some friends, but it's because there are certain reporters that cover this league that need access to people high up with team and league offices that are willing to paint them in a good light, and they have large readerships, and so people get their opinion from that.
Not like people probably Bolney or anything like that.
Yeah, people might know who we're talking about here, but and the funniest thing, I said this on Twitter today, the funniest thing about all this, well, not funny, I shouldn't say funny, but so the league today, like right after this whole thing blew up, they decided to leak very clearly, they leaked this to the AP that there was a report that said several players and staff have tested positive for COVID. Mm-hmm. And it's like, if they had just said, like, a week ago that they don't know if we're going to be able to have a season because the pandemic is still happening and right now numbers are still going up, like, that would actually be a defensible view. They could get what they wanted and still, like, not look like horrible people, and they can't even bring themselves to do that. They have such an easy out, and they still can't get this right.
Well, they're not real human beings, apparently.
They're very clearly not.
Yeah, automatons that want to make money. I don't know. Keaton, final thoughts on this topic before we move on to something a little bit more pleasant, albeit kind of crazy in the draft?
Is that more pleasant?
No.
Well, you know.
I don't. I've exhausted it.
Yeah, it's a tough... tough topic. Yeah.
Oh, actually, I have one final word.
Okay.
Not really a thought, just something that's happening right now as we're speaking. Rob Manfred is on ESPN as we speak right now a special that is called Return to Sports, with all of the commissioners talking about their return, their leagues coming back.
That is rich.
Just awful.
Yeah, that's a good look for him right there.
Look forward to a boom in lacrosse the next couple years.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. All right, so let's talk about this Red Sox draft, the 2020 draft, where the Red Sox were docked a pick for, still trying to figure that out, but, you know, didn't have a second-round pick. Chaim Bloom's first draft here, another shameful example of greed by the owners here with only having 5 rounds. But I think the biggest thing that stuck out to me about this draft, and I know, Matt, you wrote about this, and all of Twitter was freaking out about this when it first happened. The draft strategy here, which we theorized on our roundtable, we were talking about whether they should be aggressive, whether they should be conservative, and they just thought very outside the box. It was very Chaim Bloom here, but essentially what they did was they picked a player who had no business really being picked exactly where he was, a guy who was going to sign for presumably is going to sign for under slot in Nick York with the 17th overall selection. Shocked everybody. I mean, I don't even know what Harold Reynolds was doing at that point. Probably thinking of a Hall of Fame comparison.
I'll say this. I wasn't listening. I can guarantee Harold Reynolds was saying things that were no less intelligent than what he was saying for any of the other picks.
That's probably true. But nonetheless, this Nick York pick like had me... This had me shook. When this pick happened, I was like, what is this now? And then we figured out that they were trying to save money for future picks. Ultimately, what they ended up with for this four-round draft was Nick York in the first, Blaze Jordan in the third with the 89th overall pick, Jeremy Wu Yellen with the 118th overall pick in the fourth round, and Shane Drouin in the fifth with the 148th overall pick. Not a bad class, an interesting class, but Keaton, what did you think of this strategy of trying to save money on the first pick to use it later?
Hated it. Particularly with this current state of the farm where they don't really have like a true standout prospect that, you know, people will, you know, learn to know. And not having a second round pick, I thought they really kind of had to make a splash, which I guess technically they did, just not in the way we were hoping. So I'm not really a fan of it. I think that York is an interesting prospect, but just not there. There were so many more other names that I would have preferred, including one that Matt mentioned in our draft pre-cap, kid with two names that for some reason is escaping me at the moment.
Garrett Mitchell.
Pete Crow Armstrong.
Pete Crow Armstrong.
Oh, yeah. I thought you meant two first names.
Like a lot of people actually figured that was going to be the pick if he was still there regardless, and that... It just completely backfired, but I think my favorite part of all of this is York went to the same high school as Mitch Haniger, and there's this wonderful line in York's scouting report from MLB Pipeline that says, York isn't projected to go as early as Haniger did after his college career at number 38. Whoops.
Yeah, that's beautiful right there. that probably shocked Haniger, too. What did you think of this strategy, Matt?
I mean, I was mostly with Keaton for the same reasons, mainly for sort of the lack of upside at the top of the system. I really thought that Garrett Mitchell was sort of that kind of perfect, like, go big or go home kind of pick where there's honestly a pretty high bust rate with him, but if he figures it out, I mean, the tools are just so outrageous. But I was kind of willing to see it out and see what they ended up getting with that saved money. It was such a weird draft that it wouldn't have been totally crazy for somebody to really fall, and them really be able to make a big pick. Blaze Jordan, I think, is exciting. It's just, I'm not thrilled that the strategy ended up getting a first base only player with, I mean, albeit outrageous power, but still at least some questions with this hit tool. It's just not the profile I would have liked to see the strategy build around. So I mean, I'm willing to give Red Sox scouts the benefit of the doubt with York. It is my understanding that they actually do very much like him. It's not just like posturing on their part. But as far as the second pick, which I think was really the key to the strategy here, nothing against Blaze Jordan. I'm excited to see that power. And if he does, like, if he maxes out, that's an outstanding pick. It's just, there's not a ton of margin for error with the first base only prospect. And for the draft to kind of revolve around that makes me a little nervous.
His best case scenario is Joey Gallo, but even Gallo could play the outfield or third base.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take a Joey Gallo at first base, though.
Yeah, I totally agree with both of you guys on the idea of Blaze Jordan just being risky in his own right. And, you know, I was talking about this draft pick with Ian Kundle. We were texting about this. And
Humblebrag,
yeah. and basically, like, that was my exact sentiment was the fact that his profile just has no room for error. You know, if he's young for the draft, he's only 17 years old, and he's always hit for power. But you're absolutely right, Matt. Like, that's the big question with him, that he has kind of struggled against elite velocity. We don't know how his bat's going to develop. He's not really someone who's projected to play third at all. He wants to stick there, but, like, probably not. That's super risky. And also, that's somebody who you have two players already kind of like that in your system with Bobby Dalbec, who can also play more positions, okay, and has a ton of power. Kind of reminds me of it. And Tristan Casas is just frankly better at everything than he is. And obviously, you weren't going to get that caliber of player, but the three players that went after Nick York, and this is kind of the reason why I didn't like the Nick York pick where they made it, like, Bryce Jarvis, that's a really high upside college arm. Pete Crow Armstrong, even though I didn't want them to make that pick, that's a safe guy who you can pretty much figure is going to play in the major leagues with the defense already. Garrett Mitchell, like you already mentioned, that's a great option. Nick Bitsko is another high ceiling option that they could have gone with. Tyler Soderstrom is the last name I'll talk about here in the first round that I thought was a really interesting one because they're kind of weak at catcher in the system. There were just so many higher upside options than either of these two players that at the end of the day, it left me kind of underwhelmed because those were the two. You could have gotten the 4 and 5 guys without doing that strategy. It really came down to, like, what do you prefer, Blaze Jordan and Nick York, or one of those guys that we talked about?
I'll give them this. I don't think you should ever be drafting with while thinking about positions too much. Like, I don't think Costas and Dalbec should really come into play at all. Worst case scenario, you just have a bunch of really good players and you can deal from there. And I think that's the best thing that the Red Sox in particular can do, because I feel like they have such strengths and weaknesses with their development staff, where ideally you just take the players, you feed into your own strength, and hopefully everybody develops well, and then you can kind of maneuver pieces. If you have a creative GM like they hope Chaim Bloom is, and he can kind of turn those in and fill those holes on the major league roster. So I will give them credit there, because I think that's exactly what they did. I think the two things I would think about with the Red Sox development system right now is hit first middle infielders, particularly ones that might not have the athleticism that you think of for a prototypical middle infielder, but guys who they think could just hit, and especially now with second base. I mean, by all accounts, I think that York should be a pretty good defensive second baseman, but with shifting, you don't need to be all that great there anyways. So if he can hit, he can hit, and the Red Sox have developed that a lot. And then, I mean, you already mentioned with Dalbec and Casas and Chavis before that, they've been doing pretty well lately with power hitters that have come in to professional baseball with some hit tool questions and kind of figuring that out. So I think there is something to be said about leaning into your strengths, and they did do that. It's still not a strategy I love, but I can see some sort of rationale from that lens, at least.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense. I do agree with that, Matt. Keaton, I want to swing over to you for a second. When they did take York, or when they did take Blaze, were there any players on the board still that kind of stood out to you as guys you wish they had gone for rather than who they took?
Yeah. Well, you touched on Nick Bitsko. He was my number one target that I reviewed with Matt in our draft preview that I would have liked to have seen the Red Sox go after that could have really made a splash. And it's kind of a double whammy. Not only did they pass on him, he landed at Tampa, who is in your division and is notoriously successful for developing high ceiling pitching. So that's not great. Not really looking forward to that, because he'll probably, in short time, be mowing down.
Good news is he'll be traded after 3 years in the majors.
That too, yeah. Won't make it through the full six or whatever the control plan is after the new CBA. But, I mean, he's a guy that I think really could have popped. Not only helped the farm system at a position that they don't really have a lot of interesting talent at in terms of pitching, and also could have been that, like, name that pops as that, like, could be replacement for kind of like Michael Kopech, like, top of the farm, lightning rod prospect. I was really hoping that was the way they were going to go. It turned out not to be the case.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Those are two great names. That, you know, what also hurt me too is before Nick York went, the two bullets that hit me right in a row were the Phillies picking Abel and the Cubs picking Howard. Both of those guys were guys I was really hoping would be around when the Sox picked.
And then it took 40 minutes for them to actually announce the pick.
The Red Sox pick?
Yeah.
Yeah, what was up with that?
That was the longest was not week. Worth it.
Yeah, it was, come on.
Like, oh, I was expecting, I was like, all right, this is taking forever, but we're going to get a good name here. This is great. We're going to get there. And then they took York, and I was like, this seems just like a massive waste. They couldn't
what
have done
channel did you guys watching on?
I was flipping back and forth. Honestly, I was trying to figure out which one I liked better, and I liked different things about both broadcasts.
ESPN was doing these comparisons on exit velocity and just like different Statcast numbers with major league players, and it was the most outrageous thing I think I've ever seen.
Who was the player they compared to Mike Trout on exit velocity?
I don't remember. It was like a second round pick, and they're like, this guy hitting with a metal bat had a couple of exit velocities the same as Mike Trout. It's like, cool, that's useful information.
Yeah, that's pretty good. All right, so let's talk a little bit about Nick York here for a second. So this first round pick, even though we were all shocked by the pick, he's a guy who was kind of ranked all over the place by a bunch of different publications. MLB had him 139, BA had him 96, Perfect Game had him all the way at 236. So he wasn't extremely highly ranked, but then the comments by the Vanderbilt coach, I'm blanking on his name right now, saying that he was the best hitter in the country amongst high schoolers. That was really kind of telling, and that fits in with what you were talking about, Matt, about the hit-first middle infielder, and that actually was pretty encouraging. And the more that I read up on Nick York, the more I did actually like the player. And had they picked Nick York in the third where they took Blaze Jordan, I would have been psyched. But it seems like he would have been a hard sign, and they were worried that he was going to be gone by then.
Yeah, I don't think there was any chance he would have worked as a third-round pick. Like you said, either he wouldn't have been there, or if he was, especially if they picked somebody more that would have signed for at least slot in the first round, they wouldn't have had the money to get him to sign away from his college commitment, which I can't remember off the top of my head. Arizona. So, yeah, I mean, if they really liked him, and that's another thing in the draft. Like, you got to pick your guy as much as it might pain your fans, AKA me. If you have a guy that you really like, you got to do it. And yeah, I mean, some of these quotes about Nick York being the best hitter in the country and stuff like that sort of feels like the quotes that you hear when you're just like a surprise pick in any sport comes. And then all of a sudden it's like, all right, I got to search for the people that'll say the most outrageous, nice things I can hear about him. So I kind of take quotes like that, a little bit hyperbolic quotes, with a little bit of a grain of salt, but I do think that there has been a common theme about him being a very good hitter, and one who, I mean, it's not just he has a good hit tool, he also has a really good approach, and that's just something, especially with this weird summer where he's not really going to be able to get that professional coaching maybe that you would expect a pick to get right away. To have that kind of base already set in, I think, is a little bit of an advantage that isn't really something you usually have to worry about.
Maybe he can be the Red Sox version of Jaylen Brown.
That would be outstanding.
Yeah,
I'm not getting my hopes up for Jaylen Brown.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Keaton, I want to ask you, because, you know, over at the Dynasty Guru, you're always looking at prospects. Which of these two players do you think has more ceiling to them between Nick York and Blaze Jordan, looking at their two profiles? Because I think even though Nick York probably ends up with a little bit more money, I think the Red Sox probably view these guys kind of similarly. And if we're looking at rankings too, not that this matters to the team at all, but MLB had Blaze at 42, BA had him at 90, Perfect Game had him at 35. So he had quite a bit more hype.
Perfect Game had him at 35?
35, yeah.
That's crazy. I mean,
do you...
Pipeline had him at 40-something.
Yeah, so that's MLB, yeah. MLB Pipeline had him at 42. But I'm going to open this up to both of you guys. Maybe Keaton hit this one first. But who do you think has more ceiling out of these two?
Yeah, I think it's Blaze. Just electric power like that usually tends to carry a ceiling. And then he has a much lower floor. They're kind of stereotypical for their builds, like massive power, first base only, can have massive upside, like a Joey Gallo, where we could see, you know, a 220 but 50 dingers, or somebody with like a really high floor like York, because of his hit tool and his approach, that he doesn't necessarily need any like sparkling carrying tool. Although what is concerning is his shoulder surgery and where eventually he will end up playing. They feel confident that he'll be able to play at second base, but in the last full season that he was able to play, he was a DH only the entire season, which is a little bit concerning.
Well, that's only because he was recovering from surgery.
Yeah. And then, so we didn't really get to see him this spring to see how he's been recovering, but I think that's something to keep an eye on, that, like, if he ends up, shoot, the guy for the Rockies, I can't remember his name now. Not Rogers, but
Daniel Murphy.
No,
Garrett Hampson,
the kid. Oh my God, Forrest Wall.
Oh yeah, okay. Similar, that's going back similar, a few years.
Yeah, but really similar profiles. Hit first, carrying tool. Both played shortstop. Shoulder surgery was going to force them to second base, and Forrest Wall really hasn't been able to make the most of it, but
bounce around the Blue Jays organization last year.
What's that?
Forrest Wall, Blue Jay last year.
Right.
We got the number one Forrest Wall fan on the podcast.
Everybody needs a fan, man. So it's just something to keep an eye on. But with his hit tool, he certainly has the higher ceiling or higher floor. I think the higher ceiling is just the gaudy power of Blaze. He'll be able to put on a show, which is going to, you know, be very enticing.
Where do you land on this, Matt?
I think it's York. The downside is certainly there, but if we're talking about ceiling, the ceiling would be at least second base. There's still some hope, I think, a little bit of optimism that he could go back to shortstop. I wouldn't count that into his ceiling because the Red Sox themselves said that they see him at second base, so I wouldn't even consider that. But even so, we have a middle infielder, very good hit tool, obviously the approach we already talked about. I would think I'm not as worried about the shoulder as you are. I guess maybe I'm being naive on that. You kind of scared me a little bit, but I'm still saying, at least if we think about it's okay, I'm easily scared. If we're thinking about ceiling, like, that definitely involves him sticking at second base. And as far as the fielding, taking away the arm, just the covering ground and all that, he can certainly be at least average, maybe a little bit better than average at second base. And then offensively, he can be very good. And, I mean, I've said it a million times, if I'm betting on anybody to outperform their power projections a little bit, it's the guy who has the hit tool and the approach. So even if he has, like, average raw power, that's playing, that can play as average in-game power. So, I mean, I think I obviously see the ceiling with Blaze Jordan, but if Nick York hits a ceiling, and we should always say, because I don't want to make it sound like I'm hyping up too much, ceiling is far from the most likely outcome. But a ceiling for a relatively realistic ceiling for Nick York is an all-star caliber player on a regular basis, a guy that can hit and hit for solid power, hit for plus average and on base percentage, and play a good second base. I mean, that's just an outstanding player that I don't think a first base profile can really reach unless they're like a top five hitter in baseball, and I'm not sure I'm willing to put that ceiling on Blaze Jordan.
Well, that ceiling sounds like a pretty good pick at 17, then.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. The Red Sox do such a good job of developing position players and finding guys like this who are maybe a little undervalued. I'm with you, Matt. I do tend to gravitate towards guys with more of a similar profile, Nick York, than Blaze Jordan. I do like him a little bit better. I am a little bit worried about the power developing, or maybe not developing, I should say. But the reports are that, you know, along with his hit tool, he does have like this nice two-hand finish and a little bit of natural loft to his swing. So it's not hard to imagine a right-handed bat with that profile taking advantage of Fenway Park as well.
Yeah, I don't really think about draft picks in terms of where they're going to land. Because, I mean, Nick York could get traded easily. I'm just thinking about it in Nojo Park. But yeah, I mean, even especially at Fenway Park, that seems like a profile that would thrive. Especially being able to go all fields and take advantage of right field as well.
Yeah. All right, so last two picks that the Red Sox made in this draft. A little bit less interesting, as I mentioned, two lefties, both college lefties. I'm going to go to you first on this, Keaton. Do you have any thoughts or any kind of preference between these two players out of Jeremy Wu Yellen and Shane Drouin as one you find more interesting than the other?
Yes. Drouin is much more interesting to me for his ability to strike people out. It's much more effective than Wu Yellen, and we like sexy strikeouts here. However, the struggles that he has are not really typical of what you would see from a college arm, which is probably, you know, I mean, if he was more polished, he probably would have gone higher. But he really doesn't have a refined arsenal and also kind of lacks control. The ceiling is there, and from the scouting reports that I read, they all kind of are high on what he could be and what he projects to be, just not what he currently is. He's just really raw for your average 21-year-old college arm. That's a little concerning to me, but I mean, he's with his arsenal, he was pretty effective for the college game. So I'm a little concerned, but the flashes that he can show is like a high volume strikeout kind of starter, and those are exciting. So I'm much more interested in Drouin. I'm just not entirely sure he'll get there.
Yeah, that's the thing Paul Toboni said about him that I found really interesting after they took Drouin, is I think the quote was that he just has so much more runway left to develop for a college arm than you typically get with guys like that.
Yeah.
Matt, is that the way you felt as well between these two guys, that Drouin has a little bit more ceiling there?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think there's a debate. I mean, yeah. I think that's basically just fact. I mean, just to kind of piggyback off what you guys are saying, there's a reason that Drouin is a little bit more raw, and the reason that the Red Sox say that about his runway is that he just started focusing only on baseball a couple of years ago. He was a quarterback in high school as well, so he was kind of a two-sport guy right up until he got to college. So just generally speaking, those are the guys that you say get him in front of a professional pitching development team, and they can kind of take him to the next level, and that's absolutely true. The only downside to that is we're talking about the Red Sox pitching development team, which doesn't have the best track record. But they have been a little bit better the last few years. Even just looking back last year at a guy like Chris Murphy, who also came out of the draft with big stuff and some major control issues. It was a very small sample size. We got to see more out of Murphy until we can really be totally sold. But he had a very good first taste of the majors. So, I mean, that's a profile that they've had recent success with. Thad Ward was kind of a similar guy as well, although from the right side. So, I mean, I think there is reasons to be optimistic about Drouin. And in terms of, like, pure value, in terms of, like, round where a guy was picked, I think Drouin was my favorite pick of the draft.
Well, that leads me to my next question, which is excellent. I was going to ask you guys about your favorite picks of the draft.
Stepping right on your toes over here.
Yeah, you know what? I'm actually with you, Matt, and I'm going to piggyback off you. That is who I was going to say was my favorite pick of the draft, too, because as much as I do like Nick York, and I have come around on Nick York since they picked him and shocked me and made me swear at my TV, Shane Drouin is super interesting, and the fact that, you know, he was ranked 147 by MLB Pipeline, 189 by BA, 104 by Perfect Game, and the more I read about the offerings that he does have that are just inconsistent for all the reasons you just mentioned, they make me really interested in Drouin and his potential development here. Keaton, we'll go with you. What is your favorite pick of this draft?
I like Blaze for not only his power potential, and but it's got a great name.
I was going to say, his name is Blaze.
Yeah, yeah. A-plus name.
Also, I think we should...
I was just going to say that the graphic, the video clip of him bumping chests with Mookie Betts is also like very endearing. That probably hurt a little, huh?
I wish I cut you off and then just kept going. I feel kind of bad. I want to put a little bit more respect on Wu Yellen. I think he's probably a reliever, but I mean, he did show some good stuff in college. He had some big strikeout rates out of the bullpen. In shorter stints, he can get his fastball up to like 95, 96. He's got like this, I love a big slow curveball. And according to scouting reports, he's got the big old slow curveball. And he's got a changeup that's been pretty solid against righties. So the control is going to have to be figured out. And he's probably a reliever, but I think he's a guy to keep an eye on at least. And a guy who could theoretically at least move relatively quickly if they just put him in the bullpen right away.
I believe he ranked in the top 12 of relievers in college baseball by, I think, Baseball America or one of those publications ranked him as one of the best relievers in college baseball this year, too. So it's not like he was without credentials, and he had that really good outing against Vanderbilt this year, too.
Yeah, I don't know where – I mean, Baseball America had him 261 in the draft class. Fangraphs had him 183. He pitched on the Cape – last summer, and people were impressed by what he showed off there. So, I mean, he's going to be an underslot guy. He was signed, or he was drafted, I think, mainly to save a little bit of money, and they're going to use a little bit of money on that for Drouin, who's probably going to be a little bit overslot. But, I mean, in a four-round draft, I just feel bad to not talk about 25% of it. Or a fourth-pick draft, I should say.
We also got to get that guy some Twitter followers. He's at like 400 followers.
Will Yellen?
Followed him. Yeah.
Here's a funny story about his Twitter. So I was looking at his Twitter when he got drafted, and he had a tweet that said, "Wyoming isn't real." That was it. Three words. And I thought it was hilarious, so I retweeted it, and he immediately deleted it.
Oh, no.
So I don't trust his Twitter game anymore.
Oh, no.
You got to stand by your tweets, man. That was a hilarious tweet.
That's great. All right, so let's go quickly here. What was your least favorite pick of the draft, Keaton? You don't have many choices.
Yeah, really don't. I'm going to go with Wu Yellen, unfortunately. Man, it sounds like I hate this kid, and I don't mean for it to sound like that.
I hope he's not listening.
There's a lot of questions, you know? There's a lot of questions with Wu Yellen right now.
Yeah.
Matt, what was your least favorite?
I guess Blaze Jordan, just for the reasons I was saying earlier, it's not really his fault, but just the way that the draft shook out and the way that it sort of put all of this pressure on the second pick, I just would have liked something more than a first base only guy.
Yeah, that's very fair. I felt similarly there. I guess I'm going to go with Nick York, not because I don't like the player, but I just hated where they took him.
Don't hate the player, hate the game.
It's exactly what it is. So if Nick, for some reason, is listening to this podcast, very nice Thanks. Player.
Rate and review, please.
Yeah, please. But yeah, I thought there were so many different directions that they could have gone in that would have been more beneficial for the team. Ultimately, he'll probably like become an all-star and I'll love him or something, but you know, it is what it is. But let's get our draft grades before we nail up this subject and talk about the free agent signees. Matt, grade this draft for me.
Well, I already put it in writing, so I can't go back on it now. I gave it a C+.
Mm-hmm. It's like a 78. All right, we'll take it. Where are you at with this, Keaton?
Yeah, I was thinking C.
Yeah.
Well, you hate Will Yellen, so you got to go after it lower them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a solid C as well. I just think
so. I'm the high man on this draft. I like it.
Yeah.
The Red Sox defender has logged on. Classic Red Sox homer over here.
Apparently, you just have nothing critical to say about the team ever, Matt. That's what everybody always says about you.
That's what they always say about me.
All right, so we weren't particularly impressed with this draft, but one way that the Red Sox could make up some ground here on other teams, and one of the things that I think is really interesting in this whole thing, and interesting meaning that it is actually intriguing, not that I like it, because I think it's shitty that these players have to come into Major League Baseball this way, but being able to give out $20,000 unlimited to whoever you want is interesting, and the fact that these players have a little bit more agency in choosing who they sign with, I also think is interesting. And the Red Sox have already signed, what is this, 10 guys to these deals. I'll read some of the guys here, and I think that, you know, the Red Sox might have a leg up on some other teams because they have had success with player development, especially on the hitting side. So I think that that's attractive to players. But the flip side is there's a lot of opportunity here for these guys. You know, with pitchers, they see that there's plenty of opportunity in this system. With hitters, there's a lot of places where the Red Sox aren't particularly strong in the minor leagues. This seems like a pretty attractive place to come if you're one of these guys that's signing for 20 grand.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I think a lot of it also comes down to just relationships that guys had with scouts at other points, although I thought that might be more of a factor than it actually was. One of the guys, I haven't looked at any of the most recent four players that they signed. I did write about the six that they signed on Sunday. One of them had been drafted by the Red Sox before. I thought that that was going to play a bigger role than it ultimately has. But yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different reasons. I think the biggest story from Sunday was, moving away from the Red Sox a little bit, the Royals crushed it. They signed six players as well on Sunday, I believe. It's either five or six, and all but one of them were in Baseball America's top 500 for the draft class as a whole.
Wow.
Which, and if you remember, a couple weeks ago, they didn't cut any minor leaguers when everybody else was, and they committed to paying them.
Wow.
The entire for the rest of what the minor league season was. And when that happened, some agents and some players came out and said, yeah, that's going to help them in the undrafted free agency. Like, they showed that they're going to take care of their guys. And sure enough, when you treat humans like humans instead of just assets on a spreadsheet, turns out that they might actually sign with you. So hopefully that'll be a lesson to teams moving forward. We'll see.
That's the new efficiency. Treat humans like humans.
I know. It's a wild strategy. We got to wait a few years to see if it works out.
Keaton, do you think that this made the Red Sox more attractive, the opportunity, or did you kind of weigh it as, like, these guys are going to sign with who they're going to sign with, kind of regardless? What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think if... Yeah, I just think they were going to sign with whoever. I don't know if it's really giving them a leg up, just like being the Red Sox versus like some other teams. But I guess we'll see when. I'm curious to see how long this trickle of undrafted free agents goes and when it really kind of starts to peter out and we kind of can compare like entire classes. But at least so far, it doesn't seem like it's really been a leg up. It's just been guys outside the top five kind of were probably already plotting, and they were probably kind of already aware of who they were probably going to sign with, and then that's just kind of how it's fallen.
Yeah, August 1st is the signing deadline for everybody except for college seniors, so I expect that they'll be signing quite a few guys in between then, and especially because there's no cap, we could see a bunch of these guys getting added to the system. The guys that have already been added to the system, we'll give you a quick rundown here. A right-handed pitcher from Tampa, Jacinto Arredondo. A right-handed pitcher from St. Joe's, Jordan DiValerio. A infielder from Fordham, Jake McKenzie. Catcher from Puerto Rico Academy, Juan Montero. Right-handed pitcher from South Florida, Graham Hoffman. Catcher slash first baseman from Florida International, Jose Garcia. Right-handed pitcher from Puerto Rico, Henry Nunez Rio. Right-handed pitcher from SIU Edwardsville, Cole Millam. Right-handed pitcher from St. Thomas, Murphy Andrew. And right-handed pitcher from Miami, Brian Van Bell. Matt, I'll go with you first. Any of these guys kind of stand out to you as being more intriguing than the others?
Yeah, so again, I don't know about the four guys that signed most recently, but of the six guys they signed on Sunday, Jake McKenzie from Fordham is a really interesting player. He has just done nothing but hit in college and in the Cape. He's played two summers on the Cape. He entered this season as a finalist for the Bobby Bragan Collegiate Slugger Award, which I had not heard of until this morning. But it goes to a top college hitter, and it also takes academics and personal integrity into account. So it's not just straight up being a good hitter, but you have to be a good hitter to get it. And before the season got canceled, he was hitting .356, .433, .525, and he has hit, like I said, extremely well in all three of his college seasons. He can run a little bit. I think there's a little bit of question about where he'll play defensively, but I mean, a guy who's played in the middle infield and has just done nothing but hit as a guy that you're getting as an undrafted free agent. It's somebody that it's a name I'll at least remember, which unfortunately nothing against the other people. It's more about my memory and what I might've done or not done in college than anything that they have going against them. But McKenzie is going to be one of the names I remember.
Well, I will hop in here with one guy who I like very just superficially. And this is more of me taking a stand on a pitch that I'd like to see thrown more in Major League Baseball. I'm a big splitter guy. And Jordan DiValerio throws a splitter changeup and a breaking ball. So I would really like to see more splitters in Major League Baseball. So I'll also
give a quick shout out to Jacinto Arredondo. He does the little hop that I think was a Carter Capps used to do.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure it's illegal now, but he does it. By God, he does it. So it's always fun.
I watched a video on him. I think it was on the post that you made, Matt. And I was like, there's no freaking way that this guy can do this for like even an inning at a time. I have no idea. He's a tiny person. He looks he's 5'9", Hampton Beach doing that like speed pitch thing. You know what I'm talking about? Like on the boardwalk? That's exactly what I do to do the speed pitch thing. And he's doing it every time on the mound. No idea how he knows where it's going.
I mean, I enjoy it, though. I enjoy watching it, at least. I have no idea. Again, it's illegal, so he literally cannot do it. But I enjoy it. I hope he tries it as much as possible until he gets kicked out of baseball.
Yeah. Well, more power to him, I guess. All right, so let's move on here. Let's get to our listener questions. We have our first question from @ConUrban. He says, are we heading towards a total rebuild? Keaton, what do you think?
No, I don't think a total rebuild. I mean, the core of young bats should be enough that it's that dreaded retooling, not rebuilding. But like a full rebuild to me sounds like they'd be shipping off Bogarts. They'd be taking calls on Devers, Benintendi. And I just don't think that's going to happen. So they have enough of a core in place now that they should be able to add to it and have themselves a contender. They just have so much work to do on the pitching side. That's just really the struggle. So, I mean, maybe rebuild the pitching, sure, but the entire team, no, I don't think so.
Yeah, I'm in full agreement with you there. Do you have anything to add to that, Matt?
Yeah, a full rebuild is what the Orioles, Tigers, Marlins, et al. Have done. That would literally not be allowed in Boston. Fenway would actually burn to the ground, so no, they would never do that.
All right, well, it's 2020, so anything can happen.
Fair enough.
Boston Red Sox asks us, if we finally play this, which of the Boston prospects would be ready to go upstairs by now? That is not a term I usually hear for get promoted, but
I hate that a lot.
Yeah. What do you think, Matt? Who would be ready to go up to Boston?
Like right away?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like it wouldn't be anybody different. I guess like some of the, maybe the borderline guys, like a Bobby Dalbec and maybe a Tanner Houck. You would see right away instead, but like I certainly don't think like a Jeter Downs or Jaron Duran or anybody's going to get pushed super hard.
Yeah, and I think that overall, this is a negative thing for prospects. This is all missed development time for those guys.
It's a bold take, Jake.
Yeah, it's...
A lack of baseball is bad for prospects.
Yeah. Well,
this is why we keep you around.
Sometimes you just got to say the things that need to be said.
You got to step out on that limb. I get it.
All right, next question. A should-have-been in Omaha money asks us, would the Red Sox have been better off holding on to Mookie now that the season is shortened? Would potential surprise contender have coughed up more mid-season if they got off to a surprising hot start? Let's go with you, Keaton. What do you think about this one? This is a Mookie question, so I hope it's not triggering for you.
Well, I mean, I don't know if that can be avoided. But no, they would not have been better off because no one is going to. So if we're playing the shortened 48-game season, no one is going to cough up much for him at all to play 48 games, or if it's a, air quotes, mid-season of that 48, whenever a trade deadline would be imposed, for 20 or less games. No one's coughing up Jack for that when they could just sign him for money in the offseason. If they were actually going to spend money in the offseason, which doesn't look like that's going to happen either. But no, the Red Sox would not have been better off holding on to him.
I mean, he would have been borderline untradeable in that scenario, right?
Correct.
I'm not sure.
So maybe that would have been better in my heart for them not getting rid of him. I would have rather just preferred him to be here, so maybe.
Are we sure there's going to be trades if they do a 48-game season? I'm
absolutely not.
No idea.
I have no idea. There may not even be trades.
Yeah, they may have, like, the lead-up, like, the spring training time to make trades. But
maybe. I just mean in terms of, like, because, I mean, they're keeping everything so regional. Oh, and, like, right. Trying to limit the travel. I don't know if they want guys getting traded across coasts.
They'd have to have them quarantined for 2 weeks before they joined a new team, probably, as well. Yeah. Chris needs an escape from reality, says, what will the 2021 Red Sox roster look like? Let's just go with the big changes here, because we don't have a ton of time to spend on this particular question. But, Matt, give me one big change that the 2021 roster will have, in your opinion.
I mean, Jesus, this seems impossible to answer. I don't even know if there's going to be a 2020 season. I think they trade.
CBA doesn't run out yet, right?
What'd you say?
CBA's not run out yet.
No, but I mean, it runs out. I don't know.
I got one.
I think they're going to trade for a big pitcher in the offseason. I don't know who. Okay. But.
Oh, I went the other way with my. I think JBJ's gone. Because I don't think they're going to want to pay him.
Oh, I don't think that's a big change. I think that's expected. Yeah. Live a little, Keaton. Well, come on.
Yeah, Bogarts gets shipped out.
Oh my God.
Live a little less, Keaton.
Not that.
Yeah, don't say that. Jesus, can we cut that out?
Well, maybe just as big to me, Chavis gets shipped out.
Okay, yeah.
I'll accept that. I don't like it, but that's an acceptable answer.
I will go with Eduardo Rodriguez gets shipped out.
I can see it. I don't think I even...
Yeah.
I don't think it'll happen, but it's not totally out of the question.
I would be fine with it, depending on how much value they got. All right. Next question. Internet Ryan says, totally serious, definitely not hypothetical question. Should the Sox bring Manny back for the shortened season? Poppy with some pinch running help. Did you guys see the video of 48-year-old Manny in the cage?
I did.
Taking some hacks. He looked pretty good.
He did.
What would you do with him?
I don't know.
I'd love Manny as a coach. Like, and if we're being like honest and like not silly about it, I'd like to see Manny back in the dugout as a coach. He's been a hitting coach before.
I love Manny Ramirez, so I don't have anything bad to say about him. Obviously, I don't think he could play in Major League Baseball effectively at 48, even though he does look pretty good out there. But yeah,
Did you see that picture of the Red Sox Twitter account posted of him and Ortiz?
Dude, he looked 100.
Yeah, he did. That was frightening.
Yeah, he did not look great. Keaton, would you like to see him as a coach, or do you think he'd be a bad influence on players?
I do not think he would be a bad influence. I don't either. I'd love to see him in the clubhouse.
Yeah, he was famously a hard worker.
Yeah,
you know, all his Manny being Manny escapades, like, there were definitely negative things about Manny's personality, but being a hard worker and understanding hitting was certainly not among those detractions for him.
He was a major part of the whole idiots culture too. So like keeping people loose in the dugout and focused on the game. I'd love to have him there.
He's awesome. All right, Drew Andre has our last question, and he says, why can't teams trade draft picks? Would you be for allowing draft picks to be traded? Let's go with Matt first. What do you think?
Do we know the real answer to that?
They can trade draft picks.
They can trade the competitive sandwich picks,
yeah.
Which shouldn't be a thing anyway, so that's a whole other podcast.
I would absolutely be for trading draft picks. I think that would be great.
There's no good reason for them not to, and I honestly don't know the reason. I think it's just to like protect teams from themselves from making bad trades, which is obviously a terrible reason, but I really don't know the actual reasoning behind it.
I want to say that there was an actual incident that caused this rule to be put in place. I think that there was like an underlying thing where some team traded a lot of its picks or something like that. I could completely be making this up.
I don't think that's true. I don't think they've ever been able to trade picks.
I really think
maybe you're right. I shouldn't have said that because I don't know.
I don't know either. I don't know why I think this. I'm going to have to do some research on it because it's bugging me now. But like, I feel like there was something that caused this because it does seem dumb that every other team can do it and baseball cannot.
That's stupid.
I guess the interesting thing would be how trading draft picks with like pool considerations, like would, I don't know, would someone trade for like two top 10 picks if that would be essentially all of their pool money? I think it'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that would basically be what they would be trading for. I mean, we've seen how teams value those picks. And like when they get like the competitive balance picks or they get the compensation picks, it's not even so much about getting that like number 36 overall pick or whatever. It's what it does to your overall draft pool.
Yeah, so I guess I think you guys are saying two different things. So Keaton's saying if they just traded for the picks but kept their original draft pool,
they would
affect the rest of their draft. And you're saying they would acquire the draft pool along with the pick. I think that if they did this, you would have to have the pick in the pool slot combined with each other, right?
I mean, they are. That's how the pool works. Isn't it just the sum of your slot values of your picks?
Right.
So, I mean, I would assume the slot money goes with it. Nobody would trade for draft picks if they didn't get the slot money with it.
Yeah, I mean, that's how I was imagining that scenario. It's like someone trades for two top 10 picks and their entire draft class is two players.
Right. Yeah, that would drastically affect things. That would make it so the teams had to make significantly harder choices.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's interesting. I think they should be able to, Drew. Yeah, it's a good question.
I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that they shouldn't, and for some reason, they still cannot.
It's weird. It's Manfred and baseball doing dumb stuff, which is unfortunately par for the course now. So, you know, by next time we talk, maybe we will have a resolution, but probably not, because a resolution is probably 2 weeks away and
a whole lot of more BS.
Yeah, it's not good. What's the saying from Batman? The night is darkest before the day. Is that the one?
That's not Batman. That's just a quote.
It's definitely made famous by which Batman was that? The Christian Bale one, the second Christian Bale one, the one
Jake.
With
no,
Joker.
It's not that quote. Is an extremely famous quote that people have been saying for hundreds of years.
Who said it then?
The night is darkest before the dawn. I don't know who said it.
Yeah, exactly. If it's so famous, then who said it? Right, Batman. This is
a thoroughly embarrassing conversation for you, and I'm just going to let you dig your own grave here.
All right. Well, let's wrap this one up before any more Batman quotes come out. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you did, go on, rate and review us, subscribe to the show, comment about how great this pod is. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow Matt at MattRYCollins. You can follow Keaton at The Spoken Keats. You can follow me at DevJake. And you can follow the Over the Monster account at Over the Monster. Matt, what are you working on this week? Anything good coming out?
I wish you didn't ask that because I don't really have anything to promote except for your stuff.
All right. What are you working on, Keaton?
Oh, you know, round tables and such.
Oh, you're writing about some video games this week.
Yeah.
What game are you going to be writing about?
Well, before we get into that, just a recap of last week. So last week's was our what we wanted the draft strategy to be. And my take was I wanted them to not have a draft strategy, completely blow it up, and just kind of wing it, which seems a little on the nose.
Okay, so maybe you nailed it. And we got the game one coming out. And then for me, I'm working on my all-time series again. I have Chris Sale coming out tomorrow, or today, as you're hearing this. And then I have Smokey Joe Wood coming out on Friday. So check those two out. A couple more relief forms. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We'll be with you at the same time next week.